to welcome you very warmly on behalf of Trinity College and its partners to this Goulet lecture in business ethics. The Goulet Visiting Professorship in Business Ethics was established at Trinity College through the generosity of the Goulet family. And I know that a number of you here knew John Goulet. And John's intention, and indeed I think I might say passion, in establishing this chair involved a number of elements. John was intent that a college of the university like Trinity be not simply a place where people stayed, but also a place where people engaged in ideas and were able to think and have exposure to leading thinkers, such as those who might come in the course of such a scheme as this visiting professorship. But John, as a man of business, was someone who was utterly convinced of the fact that probity and ethics were fundamental to the way in which business be done, and indeed were fundamental to success in business. John was quite sure that that not only was it the right thing to do the right thing, but that the right thing would have its own reward, and material rewards, I think, as well as those immaterial ones. So the character of the business ethics professorship has very much to do with making a contribution to the academic study of business disciplines, but also making a contribution to the broader business community in Melbourne. And this particular public lecture, which we've offered each of the last few years with our visitors, has been a means by which Trinity has sought to allow that program to fulfil John's intention to provide challenging thought about how business ethics should be done and what its influence should be in the broader community. I'm very pleased to introduce this year's Goulet Visiting Professor this evening, Ronald Jurison, who is Professor of Business Ethics at the Nyenrode Business University in the Netherlands and Director of the European Institute of Business Ethics at that university. He holds the Business Ethics Chair there, established in 1985, which is the oldest chair of its kind in Europe, a reminder that the discipline of business ethics is not one of great antiquity, even if it is one of considerable urgency at times. He's held a number of other positions and published in many of the leading journals in his field, and his textbook on business ethics, which in English is translated with the title Ethics and Business, No Excuses for Not Working Out What It's About, is the most used ethics textbook in the Netherlands. So we are delighted that he's here with us because he also expands the scope of this professorship, which has already, of course, been very international, but primarily focused on links with the United States and the leading business schools there. So we're delighted that he represents some of the best of thinking, teaching and writing that's going on in the European arena in this field as well. Ronald is a consultant to many business and government organisations in the Netherlands also. A number of our previous Goulet professors, and some of you met them and certainly heard from them before, were people who had backgrounds in philosophy, which is interesting as a way of how the humanities have been making a contribution to this particular field. As a theologian myself, I take a certain delight in saying that Ronald has master's and doctorate degrees in theology, indicating that it's not only human but divine letters, which might actually be able to make a contribution to the very pragmatic questions of business ethics as well. So it's a great pleasure on your behalf to welcome Ronald Jurison and to invite him to speak to us this evening on managing for organisational integrity. Please welcome Ronald Jurison.
Thank you. Thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, before I start my lecture, I'd like to thank the Goulet family for the opportunity that they give me through the Trinity College here in Melbourne to do this professorship. And it's a great pleasure for me to be, for 1 month, the Goulet Professor of Ethics in Business. Let me see if I can get this going. Yeah. Slowly starts. Okay, this is where I come from, Europe. I have here, you have the two images overlaying each other, and the Netherlands, the country that I am from, is here in the middle. And you can't read it, but it actually says Holland, which is a bit of a misnomer. It's like calling Great Britain England. So Holland is only a part of the Netherlands. You see the differences between the country. Australia makes a massive impression, a big land mass, compared to which Europe looks much more higgledy-piggledy, doesn't it? So it's a much more fragmented continent. This is the university that I work, Nyenrode Business University. This is our main building. I saw that Trinity College has beautiful buildings, so we have a beautiful building as well. Not that I work here. This is mostly for representative functions. Coming to Australia, it struck me what a huge country it is. Quite different from where I come from. And by way of an introduction, I have a couple of observations that I would like to make that compare the two countries. And what I found is that in many cases, Australia is more impressive, bigger, larger than what we are used to in Holland. This, for example, is a sizable Dutch truck. You know, this was really a big truck by Dutch standards, but nothing compared to an Australian truck, you see. It's much bigger, so you wouldn't dare to overtake a thing like that, and people would panic if they would encounter such a beast on the highway. When we go to animal life, we have frogs in the Netherlands. There you have a typically Dutch frog. You see, it's a small beast that you can hold in the hand. But if you go to Australia, you can see these big animals. So it's really, everything is just, you know, more and bigger and larger. Then we go into sports. Both our nations are quite sporty nations. This is our national football team. They did quite poorly lately, so we're not very proud of that. But then Australian football teams, they're much bigger, you see? So everything is bigger blokes and more of them. So everything is... So being an academic, I like to generalize, and I think my general theory about the relationship between the two countries can be expressed in a simple formula. O is NL squared. Yeah? And that means that it is true that for any quantity of a substance found in the Netherlands, you'll be able to find a much larger quantity of that in Australia. So this is my theory. And let's see whether that has any predictive power. I think it has. This, for example, is the richest woman that we have in our country. That is Queen Beatrix. She's incredibly wealthy, and no one really knows how wealthy she is. My theory predicts that in Australia, there must be at least one woman who's more wealthy than she, and that is indeed the case, as you see. So these are some impressions that I have, to begin with. Ladies and gentlemen, Wall Street, we have a problem. Our current economies and societies are going to a series of crises, maybe an avalanche of crises, the one causing the other. We've had the subprime crisis in 2006, and that created the banking crisis of 2008, epitomized by the fall of the Lehman Brothers. That developed into, at least in Europe, into the sovereign debt crisis. Now, as nations are indebted, the nations are sometimes called the pigs, Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain. And you can nicely abbreviate that to pigs. And then this sovereign debt crisis that created a euro crisis. You know, people are losing confidence in the common currency. And in the wake of the euro crisis, people are beginning to lose confidence in their political leaders. And they're beginning to lose confidence in the capitalistic system as a whole, and then we're in deep trouble. So the public trust in financial organizations, banks, insuring organizations, financial intermediaries, accountants, real estate developers, that has all received a terrible blow in Europe. So that's why, for example, in the UK, there has been edited the famous Kay Report, chaired by the famous economist John Kay, and they say financial intermediation depends on trust and confidence, and everything in this report is all about trust and confidence, as you can see. So I think that trust is very important for businesses, one of the key assets of business. And how does that work? Well, business transactions are built upon trust, and trust is the willingness to put your own interest in someone else's hands. That is trust. And when do you trust a person? You will trust a person when he or she is honest, fair, responsible. That means a person of integrity. And that's why I think that taking care of the integrity organization makes perfect business sense. And ethics is good business, as John Gourlay also used to say. Ethics creates profits. That's not the only reason why you should do it, but I think that it does. Now, so we're talking about integrity, and what do we mean by integrity? Well, I have here with me three views of what integrity in business can mean. First of all, it simply has to do with a set of rules. Integrity is about keeping the basic rules of ethics in society. You don't steal, you don't lie, you don't cheat. Let's put it to a test. What do you think? Offending someone's late father, would that be ethically, would you be on the safe side or more on the dangerous side? I would say you're more on the dangerous side, yeah? That would create a red flag, yeah? It's not that difficult, ethics. You have to keep to the rules. Okay, but the rules are not enough. You also need, second dimension of ethics, an internal compass, that's your ethical conscience. Can I look at myself in the mirror? And that enables you to improvise. You know, following the rules is not creative, but sometimes the rules don't tell you what to do. You need just ability to improvise. So that's the second dimension of integrity that we are talking about. And finally, you shouldn't try to do that on your own, I think. You should also consult the opinion of others, which means that integrity also has a dialogical side to it. So what is business integrity in my view? It is following the rules, that's important, but it's not enough. You also have to consult your conscience and you have to dialogue with others. And that's my first introductory statement about integrity in business. Now let's talk about managing integrity in business. I think there are two dimensions to it, and you can symbolize them by the apple and the barrel. The one dimension is the integrity of management, so that's the personal ethical behavior of managers. And the second dimension is how they manage integrity of the organization, so how they take care of the barrel. Yeah, you have to be a good apple, and you have to take care of the barrel. And I would like to structure my lecture according to this distinction. I will talk about apples, and I'll talk about the barrel. And if you combine the two, then you are ethically effective, as you can see. Then you're in the upper right quadrant here. So you give the good example, and you manage it. And if you don't do any of the two, you're unethical, and we all know. And if you only manage integrity, but you don't mean it, then you're a hypocrite. And I call someone who has the good ethical character but doesn't manage it, I call that person ethically neutral. That means you are a good business manager, an honest person, but you don't really optimize that in your organization. And I think you should. Here's some research about talking about apples. What are characteristics of CEOs involved in corporate scandals? It's by a Dutch colleague of mine, Kees Kools, and he has compared 25 companies that were involved in big corporate scandals with a control group of 25 others. And he discovered the following differences. First of all, there are excessive financial incentives. Incentives in the 25 corporate scandal corporations were 8 times higher than in the control group. Second factor is sunken behavior. When managers and directors start talking about themselves and their company in the first plural form, like we, and they mean themselves, then you should take care. High press coverage is also an indicator of troubles. When someone is nominated CFO of the year, I don't know if there are any CFOs of the year in this audience, take care. Unrealistic growth targets. It's another sign of things going wrong. And the non-intervention by non-executives and supervisory board members. I will not deal with corporate governance that much in my lecture, but that's another indication of things going on. And the market has already noticed it. That is fascinating. There was a 40% drop in share price prior to the scandal. So the market, the insiders already knew what was going on. And formal corporate governance doesn't matter. Formal ethical programs do not have a big effect on the integrity. Now, how can we understand this behavior of business people? I think there are a couple of interesting views. And the first one that I find interesting is by David Owen, American, English politician and author. And he has written a beautiful book on the hubris syndrome, and the syndrome of being overcourageous. And he, as you can see, he talks about Blair and Bush in the Iraqi crisis. He also writes about Margaret Thatcher. And he says the following: a hubristic career proceeds along something like the following course. The hero wins glory and acclamation by achieving success. And the experience then goes to their head. They begin to treat others with contempt and disdain, and they develop such confidence in their own ability that they begin to think themselves capable of anything. And this excessive self-confidence then leads them into misinterpreting the reality around them and into making mistakes. And finally, that brings their nemesis, their destruction. And I think that's quite recognizable in corporate scandals. They often are the result of success. Yeah? What goes up must come down. Pride comes before the fall. I think this is an important lesson to learn. Another similar theory that brings it one step further is the Bathsheba syndrome theory of Loneker. Yeah, Ludwig and Loneker. It's somewhat older, as you can see, 1993. And their key metaphor is the story, the biblical story of David and Bathsheba. It's called the Bathsheba syndrome. It's actually a bit unfair to her because you should rather call it the David syndrome, because he's the problem. There you have King David, and he's a very famous king, a hero, second king of the unified Israel, and he's won a lot of wars. But then he does something very odd. He stays at home while there is a war going on, and at a certain moment he sees this beautiful woman, Bathsheba, and he falls in love with her, obviously. He has her, and this is the moment that we see. He calls her into his apartments, and he sleeps with her, and not only that, because she gets pregnant. And then a problem emerges because she is married to Uriah the Hittite, one of his generals. And what does he do? To cover up, he tries to bring Uriah home so that he will sleep with his own wife. But then Uriah refuses because he is a really ethical general. He says, I want to stay with my men. We're in battle. So he won't come home. What then? Okay, then send him to a very dangerous place in battle, and he commands Uriah to be led into a certain place in battle where he will be certainly killed, and that happens. Next, David marries Bathsheba, and the child is his. So this is an outrageous story. This man was so successful, and how can he do this series of very immoral acts? The explanation is by the authors is this: there was an initial resounding success, and that made him lose his mind. He thought that he could get away with everything, even murder. So he loses his strategic focus as well. He should be in battle. He should govern. And instead of that, he's doing all kinds of things that, he shouldn't do. So he's losing focus. He's losing concentration. He has all the power he needs, and he abuses that, unrestrained control of resources. And he has an inflated belief in his ability to control outcomes. So it is related to the hubris syndrome, but it's taken one step further. This is really an unethical way of using and abusing your power. And I think these stories, the hubris syndrome, the Bathsheba syndrome, are very revealing about what can happen in corporate boardrooms nowadays. I'll give you one example. This is from a report, there we go, a couple of lines, from 2008, the RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, Group International Audit Report. And they've written a couple of very worrying lines about boardroom dynamics. The GEMC, General Group Executive Management Committee, are not operating as a team. Convergences are typically bilateral. Performance targets consume too much of the agenda. Discussions seem bullying. The atmosphere is often negative and is at a low point currently. And this is going on in the boardroom of one of the biggest banks in Europe. I find that really shocking to read. It's the same year in which RBS took a loss of 31 billion euros, caused, among other things, by their attempt to take over ABN AMRO, which was a tremendous business disaster in Europe. So they took a lot of losses, and they had this atmosphere in their boardroom. And I see similarities to the hubris syndrome and to the Bathsheba syndrome. When top management communicates only bilaterally, and people don't act as a team, well, that's quite similar to the contempt for advice of others that you saw in the hubris culture. They don't even want to listen to each other anymore. And when performance targets consume too much of the agenda, people have a kind of narrow-minded focus. Yeah, that's a loss of strategic focus that you saw in the Bathsheba syndrome case. And I also see a loss of contact with reality. Yeah, if people are just infighting, incomprehensible. How can that be? Well, the hubris syndrome, the Bathsheba syndrome, explanations give us some psychological explanation of what might be going on And it all has to do with success and people going out of their mind. Okay, what's the conclusion? We're talking about apples still. What should these apples take away from this? Well, I think this simple lesson. I have to be able to read Greek, but I'll translate it for you. It says, gnoti se auton, know yourself, know thyself. It's an inscription in the Apollo temple in Delphi. So what can managers learn from these cases? I think that they should take notice of these cases, that they should read them, discuss them, and understand the psychological mechanisms that are going on. That's the only way they can, you know, get out of this crisis. You have to become aware of the biases and inclinations that you have, and thereby overcome them, or correct them and control them. So managers have to heal themselves. We can't heal them in that respect. The Huber syndrome and the Bathsheba syndrome cannot be overcome from the outside. People have to overcome that from the inside. You know, they have to convert, to use a theological term. So far for the apples in my talk, ladies and gentlemen, let's go to the barrel. Managing integrity means integrity of management. I covered that. Now let's go to the barrel. Management of integrity. What can we say about the organization as barrel? Of course, it's only a metaphor. The apples are in the barrel. And in the barrel, we see the following. I think that ethical behavior of employees, people, and organization is driven by two influencing factors, cultural and structural. Well, that's not a big deal, but within culture, you have leadership, values, informal norms, language. What to think of a bank that calls their clients Muppets? That kind of testifies to a certain culture. Yeah, if you hear those things, you take care. What's going on there? They call their clients Muppets. At Arthur Andersen, they call their biggest prospects, they were called elephant targets. You were going after, you know, chase elephant targets. You know, it has a certain cultural implication if you talk about your clients like that. To develop and support certain values, you have to build a structure. It's the structure of the organization that has to support the values. It's the medium is the message in this respect. So the structure has to support the culture, and on the other hand, the culture has to support the structure. I will give examples of both. Let me take the example of Trinity College, where I'm staying for a month. I was struck by the strong set of values that they have there, and by the way they work that into the structure of the organization. So you have the college system. Students live together on campus, so work together very, very close, very strong interaction, and that really brings across the message of the college system. You want to train these people for becoming the next generation of leaders. And you can talk to them for endlessly, but you have to make that into an experience. And I think so the structure of the Trinity College creates the experience. So the structure supports the culture. Simple example. And that's important. The other way around, the culture also has to support the structure. And then employees will receive a consistent signal. Yeah, structure and culture are, you know, sending a consistent signal. An example that I can give is from multinationals that are nowadays trying to globalize their health, safety, and environmental policies. Yeah, that's a structural measure. You want to have this whatever, for example, at Heineken Brewery, that I do a lot of consultancy for, they really want to have their HSE policies globalized, universal. But that means that on all continents, people will need the same mindset. And that's a cultural thing. So you need to globalize the training, to globalize the culture in that respect, to be able to support a globally similar structure. So it is indeed true, ethical behavior needs the corroboration of culture and structure. And an interesting story to give that some more detail are some stories about Arthur Andersen that I already discussed. Left, you see, founding father of the company, Arthur Andersen. He started his company in Chicago, and at a certain point, it was one of the biggest consultancy and accountancy firms in the world. They're one of the big five. On the right, you see David Duncan, one of Arthur Andersen's last, maybe most famous accountants. He became famous in the Enron scam, among other things, by the document shredding orgy that they did. They shredded about one ton of documents to conceal information. Here's a quote from Arthur Andersen in 1932. He said the following: "If the confidence of the public in the integrity of accountants' reports is shaken, their value is gone. To preserve the integrity of his reports, the accountant must insist upon absolute independence of judgment and action." In 1932, mind you. The necessity of preserving this position of independence indicates certain standards of conduct on which they strongly had in the company. What did this mean for Arthur Andersen's own behavior? Well, here's an interesting story. He was a very young accountant, 28, at the age of 28. He faced down a railway executive who demanded that his books be approved, or else he would take his business away. And Andersen said, "There is not enough money in the city of Chicago to induce me to change that report." A young accountant, age 28. And he lost the business. So, does ethics pay? We don't know. But later, the railway firm filed for bankruptcy, and Andersen became known as a firm that you could trust. So it did pay, ultimately. And so Arthur Andersen was known for its culture of high integrity, and that stayed so until the 1980s, and then it began to falter and ultimately collapse with the Enron scandal, the Enron scam. And how could it collapse? Well, one reason was the introduction of management consulting within the organization. It changed from a classical, you know, somewhat maybe boring accountancy ethos into a very, very dynamic management consulting firm. And so the structures changed. You know, they went into different businesses. The structure changed. And with that, the culture changed. And also, the firm's earlier commitment to ethics came to be drowned as the firm increasingly focused on revenues. Revenues became more important. So culture and structure changed at Arthur Andersen, made it a different company, and ultimately, it led to its collapse. I think that's an interesting story to note, talking about ethics, structure, and culture. Can you manage the culture of an organization? I think you can. Here is an example. I don't know if you can read it, but can you read that in the back? Yeah, okay. This is an example of consultancy work that I did for a Dutch housing organization. And we measured the culture of this organization. We have a device to do that. I'm actually working together with Robert Wood of MBS to see if we can introduce that here in Melbourne. With that instrument, we measured the corporate culture in 2009, it was, I believe. Yeah, and once in 2011. And the blue line is the first measurement, and the green line is the second measurement. And in between, we did some interventions, like a dilemma workshop and ethics training and so forth. And you see that in these 2 years, the culture has improved on all these dimensions. In particular, dimension 4 here below improved quite dramatically from 39% to 70%. That's the percentage of employees who said that the culture is good or very good. And that's the dimension of sanctionability. So to what extent are misconducts really sanctioned here in this organization? So you can see that it is possible to measure a culture, to detect it, and to manage it. And the way we do that is by instruments like this. We ask respondents, employees of the firm, to fill in a questionnaire and look at questions like this. This is our fairness scale. Let's take the third question. Employees are treated with dignity and respect in this organization. Do you strongly disagree or do you agree? And you can, through psychometrics, add that up and combine that into a research instrument. So indeed, you can know the organization's culture. You can measure that. Instruments are getting better and better. And this is something that managers, I think, should look into. Yeah, the corporate culture is not anymore something like the weather. In Melbourne, you have unpredictable weather. and you don't have an unpredictable culture in your organization, you can really do something about it. How do you manage integrity in the organization? There are two basic strategies for that. The rules-based strategy on the one hand, and the responsibility-based strategy on the other hand. And the rules-based strategy is like the following. The objective is to prevent misconduct. And I think that's very important, to prevent misconduct. But it's a negative approach. Corporate legal driven, you reduce the discretion of the employees, you tell them what they should do, what they shouldn't do. It's about the red flags. And the behavioral assumption is actually that people are guided by self-interest. They have to constantly be vigilant. And what shall we say about it? I think it's very important to have this rule-based strategy, but it's not the only thing. Because rules are not always meaningful. You have a rule, something is forbidden, but you're wondering what is actually being forbidden here, isn't it? So, how meaningful are rules? Yeah. How sometimes our rules are not clear. The clarity of rules is sometimes lacking, and also the compliance is a big problem, in particular in the Netherlands, where you have people are not so obedient. It says in Dutch, bicycles here will be removed. Yeah, they're all locked, so it will not be easy to remove all these bicycles. So, yeah, a rules-based strategy makes sense, but it's not the only strategy, I think. So, a second strategy that aims much higher, I like to call it a responsibility strategy. And the objective of a responsibility strategy is that you enable responsible conduct. And that's different from, you know, preventing misconduct. You have a positive outlook. And that's much more open. So the whole strategy is much more open. The ethos is different, leadership is different, and the behavioral assumption is different. You assume that people are responsible beings guided by values. And you can very well compare these two strategies, rules-based, responsibility-based, to the famous theory X, theory Y divide of Douglas MacGregor that many of you will know. So the rules-based strategy is theory X-based, and the other one is theory Y-based. American research has shown that the rule-based strategy is effective. It leads to positive integrity improvements, but the responsibility strategy is much more effective. It's much more ambitious, and you achieve higher goals by that. So what I recommend then is a combination, obviously, of the two, where you have the rules that you need, but the responsibility whenever possible, and you have to find a balance between the two. And where's the balance? Somewhere in the middle. So the first one is a kind of hygiene factor, but you should try to aim higher. That's, I think, my ambition. Now, if we look into the future, what possibilities do we have in managing integrity? What will it bring us? I think looking into the future, what I'm working on at the moment is, together with other people, many other people, is what we call an integrity management audit framework. And it looks like this. It's quite a complicated scheme. It's an encompassing scheme, an encompassing model for managing and auditing and ultimately certifying even the integrity of the organization. This is what we've made, me and some other academics in the Netherlands, together with accountants and also with professional certifiers, in this case of Lloyd's certifiers. It's a whole scheme. I won't go into the details of it, but it gives you the picture. Based on a lot of research, we have identified seven dimensions of managing integrity in an organization. The first dimension is the values and the vision of the leadership, of course. Yeah? You need the buy-in of the leadership. They have to understand what it's all about. Then the company will have to identify its values, second step. Then you need to create the appropriate awareness among employees. That's the third step, and then you have to look at how is the governance regulated, so how is it at the board level, and what systems of measurement do you have in place? That's the fourth dimension. Then the fifth dimension has to do with the integrity framework. So what provisions do we have for example, reporting misconducts and so on. And then we have the stakeholder involvement, that's the fifth dimension. And finally, there's legal compliance. Well, based on a lot of literature, these are seven important dimensions of managing integrity in the organizations, and you can kind of cascade that downward and fill that in onto a very operational level. That's what we're at this moment working on. And we are able to give a certificate for that to organizations. And there's some interest in that from organizations to do that. So I think that's what we'll be heading for. You can imagine that within the private law, certain companies, for example, maybe big grocery chains will expect their suppliers to have a sustainability certificate, but they could also ask an integrity or a health and safety and also integrity and governance certificate. That's what we are working on at the present. To wrap up, some recommendations for managers. Well, the first one I already said, gnotis eauto, know thyself. Take advantage of psychology, take advantage of behavioral economics as a manager, know what research is being done in that field, and you know, try to step up, you know, based on what you know. Understand the culture of your organization. Managers have to be cultural managers. Yeah, a study in sociology, cultural anthropology would be very good for a manager. And I hope I have been able to convince you that the culture of an organization is something that you can know and that you can manage. So you can and should manage the integrity of your organization. That is more than leading by example. It comprises a whole set of management instruments, and we are increasingly becoming aware of what these instruments are. You should empower your employees to take responsibility. That's the responsibility strategy. I'm a strong believer in employee empowerment. I don't think that the tone at the top, as important as it is, it's the most important. I think that you should listen to the bottom as well. So the integrity of the organization is ultimately the integrity of its people, and not only of its directorship. And that was actually the last thing I wanted to say about it, ladies and gentlemen. Tone at the top, listen to the bottom. Thank you very much.